Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and back with us now for the first time in a while is Juan Williams, Fox News commentator and former NPR senior news analyst and former host of NPR's Talk of the Nation. As you know, unless you've been under a media rock, Juan was fired from NPR last year after saying on Fox that he fears getting on airplanes with passengers dressed in Muslim garb. Much less reported was the fact that he went on to say that fears like those should not be the basis for public policy regarding airplanes or anything else. The firestorm created by Juan Williams' sacking wound up in the resignation of the NPR official who fired him, Senior Vice President for News Ellen Weiss, and cost then-president of NPR Vivian Schiller her bonus for the year. Now Juan Williams has a book that tells his side of his story and goes on to critique the stifling of honest debate from various points on the political spectrum as he sees it. The book is called Muzzled, the Assault on Honest Debate. Now, for clarity's sake on our place in this, some people confuse WNYC with NPR. We are not NPR. We are an independent local radio station that buys a lot of programming from NPR, which is a national network, just so you know how that works and what the relationship is. We buy things like Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Fresh Air, and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Many of our other programs are not NPR, including this program, Leonard Lopate, Soundcheck, The Takeaway, This American Life, Radiolab, A Prairie Home Companion, Freakonomics Radio, and others, just so you have that context. And we will try to do an honest job discussing this as we would discuss any story. So we'll talk with Juan Williams about the book and then pick Juan's brain for some political analysis of the dueling debt ceiling speeches last night and more. So hello, Juan Williams. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, it's great to be with you, Brian. Thanks for having me. I hope this doesn't create a problem for you. And I think it was important that you let people know, because people just think, well, NYC is NPR, and it's not.
Yeah, but people don't know the relationships. And there's no way this will create a problem for me. I mean, you know, I can't – it's hard for me to think of a way that talking to you would create a problem for me. But unless I went on to say – oh, never mind. I want to play a sort of longish version of the clip that got you fired. This is 48 seconds worth. Because it's been taken out of context so much, let's listen.
Look, political correctness can lead to some kind of paralysis where you don't address reality. I mean, look, Bill, I'm not a bigot. You know the kind of books I've written about the civil rights movement in this country. But when I get on a plane – I got to tell you, if I see people who are in Muslim garb and I think, you know, they're identifying themselves first and foremost as Muslims, I get worried. I get nervous. Now, I remember also that when that Times Square bomber was at court, I think this was just last week, he said the war with Muslims, America's war with Muslims, is just beginning. First drop of blood. I don't think there's any way to get away from these facts, but I think there are people who want to somehow remind us all, as President Bush did after 9/11, it's not a war against Islam. President Bush went to a mosque.
Well, there isn't any theology involved in this at all, from my perspective.
So there's a little of you with Bill O'Reilly. And then you went on to say very explicitly that you don't think, and why don't you put this in your words now, you don't think that your fear of somebody in, quote, Muslim garb or anyone else's should be the basis for public policy?
Of course not. And I said right then and right there, in that heated debate, that Timothy McVeigh is a Christian, that the people at the Westboro Baptist Church who engage in what I consider such offensive rants at funerals, at military funerals, they're Christians. The Atlanta bomber, the Olympic bomber, is a Christian. We don't make judgments about all Christians on that basis. And, of course, you know, given the news this week out of Norway, we don't make judgments about all Christians based on that man's behavior. And we needed to avoid making similar stereotypical judgments about Muslims in America based on the fact that Muslims had, in fact, attacked us. Radical Muslims who spoke of jihad had attacked us on 9/11. So this was all said at the time, Brian. And I remember when I was being fired, asking the executive, I said, you know, did you look at the transcript? Did you hear the entirety? We don't want to hear it. We've had enough, you know. And I said, you know, can I come in and talk to you about it? you know, I'd worked there more than 10 years, as you well know, and I was told, no, there's nothing you can say or do that would change our minds.
You were kind of debating Bill O'Reilly there on his Fox show. Was he arguing that some kind of policy should be based on fears like that?
No, he was arguing that he was tired of being careful in speaking about Muslims, that you always have to say that you're only talking about extremist radical Muslims having attacked us. He thinks that everybody knows that that's who he's talking about, and why does he have to tread some very thin line, say every time that the fact is that the people who attacked us were Muslims. And so I was saying, in order to try to construct a debating point, look, I understand what you're saying, Bill, but you have to be careful, in my opinion, to avoid things like, remember the cab driver in New York who had his throat slit by a guy who said he was attacking Muslims. I just don't think that we want that in an American society that from its very beginnings has embraced the idea of religious tolerance.
And if I remember correctly, maybe I don't, that guy wasn't even Muslim. He was Sikh.
Oh, I don't remember. Okay.
There were some incidents involving Sikhs who were mistaken for Muslims, which goes to the point of right. not making policy based on your reaction to somebody's garb.
Correct. And so what and here's the thing. Then subsequently, NPR people said, well, it's in violation of our journalistic ethics for him to make such a statement. And I thought, wait a second. First of all, it wasn't even a statement of opinion. It was an admission of feeling. And, and subsequently, by the way, I think this is really the birthplace of this book. So many people came to me and said, I have the same anxiety. And they don't consider themselves bigots or horrible people. They're just saying, that anxiety exists. Okay, so let's build a conversation subsequent to that. We don't have to deny our feelings. I would hope not. And, and as you pointed out, and I really appreciate this, I never said that we should base social policy or discriminate against people who are in Muslim garb on the basis of my feeling or anyone else's. To the contrary, we need to protect their rights in that situation.
So you kind of got Shirley Sherrodded. Like her, you were taken out of context to make the exact opposite point that you were trying to make and fired for it.
Yeah.
then again, if part of your job as a journalist is to maintain credibility and access to all communities, does it hurt your ability to do your job if people who wear whatever you consider Muslim garb know that you're biased to think they might be terrorists?
I don't think I'm biased. I was revealing my feelings. And I think in the aftermath of 9/11, I think I would have to be somewhat brain dead not to, have an awareness of what's going on. I mean, clearly America has changed since that moment, and airplanes, airports, so many parts of our reality have changed. So it's all around. I think people who would say don't discuss it are really trying to shut down discussion. And I think discussion is necessary because bad ideas are then allowed to prevail as a result of lack of discussion, and good ideas don't come to the fore. So to me, it would be healthier to say, this is an anxiety I feel. Now, let me just tell you that some people, I think Andrew Sullivan was one at The Atlantic, and the ombudsman at NPR was another, who said, hey, Juan Williams is black. So if we are walking down the street and we see a bunch of young black guys who are acting rowdy and loud and it's dark and laid out, and we think, oh my gosh, we have fear of these young black men. So Juan Williams would say we were bigots. But he doesn't see it when he says that about Muslims. I said, wait a second. I would be anxious if I saw a bunch of rowdy young black guys late at night on the street. I would change the side of the street or avoid that situation. So, I mean, it's just like, anything you say now will be used against you. You'll be shunned. You'll be called a crazy right winger or a crazy left winger, told, that's not the appropriate thing to say. I just think it doesn't allow for honest discussion in the society.
Now, I've never had a conversation with NPR brass about this incident, but from what I gather, there was underlying unhappiness with your role on Fox News in general that you had in addition to your NPR job, that they thought you were out there giving your opinions too much, not just your analysis, in a way that degraded your credibility as a news analyst on NPR, and also that having you on Fox so much, constantly identified as an NPR employee, hurt the brand of NPR, because NPR's brand is, polite, reasonable discourse from different points of view and deep reporting. And there you were in the hyper-commercial rough and tumble of Fox News Channel shows and amid the dishonest marketing of Fox News as fair and balanced. And I said a lot there. But do you think those were really the underlying reasons that you got let go?
I think that they were unhappy with the fact that a prominent NPR personality was also present on Fox. And they had some wild ideas like, oh, I legitimize Fox, or I allow people who come to Fox to think of it as fair and balanced when in fact it's not, they said. And, you know, I just think these are wild ideas. I think Fox would be successful if I wasn't there. I don't think that I'm the guy that makes it a success or is going to stop it from being the number one cable channel. But the larger point is that when it came to their journalistic standards, as you expressed, oh, well, you're expressing too many opinions. Well, let me just say quickly, I went to work at NPR while I was working at Fox News. I went to work at Fox News in 1997. When I was at the Washington Post, then NPR hired me in 2000. So I was already working at Fox. Second thing to say is generations of management came through the door, and whenever the issue came up from NPR listeners who objected to my presence at Fox, they came to a decision, you know what, actually it expands the brand. It, people who are watching Fox are now more aware of NPR and more aware of just the pluses that you mentioned, Brian, which is, wait a second, there's reason. A reasonable person representing NPR arguing here, making points that seemed to me to be rational, and they thought it might help. They were concerned about the possible blowback from people who didn't like the idea that NPR was related to Fox in this way. But
so their position on that changed.
Well, in the latest management team, the one that fired me. But let me just say also that there are other NPR personalities who appear on Fox, Mara Liasson, for example, who's still at NPR, and there were many NPR—
As a more restrained analyst.
Correct. Well, yeah, but we do the same shows, obviously. And one of the oddities of it is that there are many more NPR personalities who do opinion shows who say, you know, strong, very opinionated things, and they still are at NPR.
Juan Williams, my guest on WNYC. His new book is called Muzzled. We can take your phone calls for Juan Williams on his story or what's in the news right now, because he is a political analyst, and I hope we'll get a few minutes for political analysis.
Okay.
212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I want to follow up on something you said. The concern of some at NPR about the credibility of Fox News per se and yours by being in the middle of it. Mm-hmm. In your honest opinion, since your book is about how people like you should always be allowed to be honest,
right,
is Fox News fair and balanced? And is the political tabloid tone of much of the network really something you respect?
Yeah, I grew up in Brooklyn. I read tabloids. I don't have any trouble with tabloids, that aesthetic, if you want. But if you ask about the fair and balanced thing, here's what I would say. One is, very, very obviously, nobody's telling me what to say, and I'm on Fox, right? So no one says, shut up, or you're not allowed to express that opinion, or don't challenge. Never, never such a word. To the contrary, when I wanted to write op-ed pieces for The Times or The Washington Post or write books, the NPR managers were like, wait, we don't want you to do that, or we want to give you approval, or why are you doing that? Or when I appeared on Fox, why do you identify yourself as an NPR person, telling me, especially when I appeared on Sean Hannity's show, don't identify yourself as an NPR person. Like, the rest of the world didn't know I worked for NPR. I mean, come on. So I just thought that was ridiculous.
But in terms of Fox and what it actually does, let's say the Murdoch journalism world and what it actually does, here is Nick Davis, reporter for the Liberal Guardian newspaper of the UK, from our show last week on the Murdoch papers hacking scandal, describing how he sees Murdoch journalism in general.
The main way in which newspapers like to think they've got influence is through their leader comment. So they endorse a particular party at an election, and that's absolutely fine and legitimate. Then there's a second thing, which is that in the selection of the stories which you choose to tell the truth about, then I think it's also legitimate to do that.
Yes.
But then there's a different thing, which is brazen distortion, a news agenda which is set by hostility.
Reaction to that? Brazen distortion? News agenda that's set by hostility?
Now, he's talking about the newspapers. I don't know that he's talking about Fox News Channel. But I will say that I thought what he said was exactly right, that I think the stories that are selected from a conservative point of view. I think that the lead personalities on Fox, talking about here Sean Hannity in prime time, is a very flag-waving, bold, conservative. He doesn't pretend to be any kind of fair and balanced. I will say this also, that people like Sean have me on their show, and that's his choice. It's his show. But I'm allowed to argue. It's not I'm not there agreeing with them.
Don't you feel like you're used by Fox?
I think
as
this
a
is the heart of it.
Foil conservative
yes.
opinion. Let me get through a little of this.
No, but I'm saying
framing.
that's the heart, I think, of the argument that came from the people that fired me. Aren't you just a foil for these larger than life conservative ideologues, right?
Right. Because like on Fox News Sunday, it's often like Mar Lyson is there in a pretty neutral role. Then Brit Hume and Liz Cheney and even Chris Wallace, the host, are ganging up on you and guffawing and raising the eyebrow, their eyebrows like you're a buffoon. That's the script, isn't it?
I think that's the show. What do you mean?
Yeah. So what is your, so is that fair and balanced, or is that you just participating in an act of conservative propaganda where you're there to be shouted down as illegitimate?
Well, I don't think that I'm shouted down. I think that it's rough and tumble at times. But I think, to the contrary, that I'm there and allowed to express my point of view. And I think to give the audience the idea that, you know what, all that's coming from the far right in this conversation is not to be swallowed whole cloth, that there's somebody here who's offering a different point of view and doing so with some vigor. I'm not intimidated by those people. I don't think that I'm told, don't say this. Now, I do think that the lead personalities there, the biggest personalities, are really expressly conservative. But again, people say this to me all the time. Thank God you're there, because it offers some balance to what these people are saying. You offer some contrary point of view, some contrast about the way that events are shaped to an audience that's listening. So to me, if you say, oh, you're just a foil, I think to myself, well, I'm glad somebody's there to offer an alternative viewpoint. And yes, I do think that if you were to reduce it to, you know, stick figures, this person's a liberal, this person's a conservative, and this they're more conservatives than liberals. I remember I once said to the NPR folks, well, gee, when I work at NPR, I'm surrounded by more liberals than conservatives. And when I'm at Fox, I'm surrounded by more conservatives than liberals. I mean, yeah, okay, that's the media landscape we're in. But I think that I'm not only saying the same thing in these different venues, but that I'm trying to balance.
One more thing before we go to the calls, just to expand the discussion a little bit into what's in your book, because I really want to acknowledge that the larger context of your book is that this muzzling goes on all over the political spectrum. You cite Grover Norquist and the NRA and what Bill Maher calls the patriotic correctness on the right on the war in Iraq. So what's the big picture?
The big picture, and I'm really glad you did it, because obviously everybody taps into the fight, the controversy with NPR. But 90% of this book is about how, in fact, what began in the 60s in terms of political correctness and in an effort to correct the bias that's implicit in much of our language in society has evolved to the point now that with all the money that goes into the lobbying groups, all the money that goes to extremist politicians on the right and the left, and with the media landscape where people are tapped into shows that really just affirm their pre-existing opinions, it is so difficult to have an honest debate. Whether it's about immigration, if you're on the right, like President Bush was, and say, I want to do immigration reform, the right-wing radio talk hosts go bananas and say, oh, you're for amnesty. You want to give amnesty to criminals. If you want to talk about guns in this country, the NRA absolutely shuts down the debate. They have big money coming in from their folks. They give big money to politicians. You can't have the discussion. You want to talk about Afghanistan. Why is it that the U.S. Senate, you never hear a discussion about why we're in a war in Afghanistan for 10 years, spent so much money and so much blood. If they bring anybody in, they just bring in generals who say, we should win this war. Win what? What are you talking about? Win this war. Come on. But debate now in this country is stultified. And the best example, Brian, would be the budget debate going on in Washington, on Capitol Hill. These people are locked in by extremist positions on both sides, more so to me on the Republican side.
Is that why you referenced Grover Norquist?
I sure certainly did. I think this business about pledges of no taxes. Well, where's the idea that we really do have a debt crisis and there should be some sacrifice? Why is it that you can't tax the very rich in this country? How bizarre is that to my mind? It's not like we're overtaxed. If you look at it as a percentage of GDP, we're at the lowest point in 60 years. So I think, on so many issues, it's just hard. Look, even in this city, New York City, Tony Kushner, the playwright, when he says, and this is a guy who's a supporter of Israel, says, yeah, but I have some questions about Israeli policy, is they'd want to deny him an honorary degree until there's a backlash and the honorary degree is given. I think it's an indicator of how much you will be shunned, you will be stigmatized, or in my case, fired, for simply expressing your opinion and trying to have an honest debate.
Do you think, by the way, on the debt ceiling debate, that there really is an equivalent on the Democratic side to the Grover Norquist? Because that side is saying, you know, ultimately John Boehner is too afraid to have any kind of compromises that includes revenue raisers. Obama is having this, you know, is presenting himself with as the compromiser, mm-hmm. presenting 75% spending cuts to only 25% revenue raising, and doing things that, you know, infuriated Paul Krugman in his column the other day, like agreeing to raise the eligibility age for Medicare, right. means test Medicare. So is there an equivalent right now, in your opinion, in that situation?
I don't think the president said he would means test Medicare. I think he said on, like, premiums for Plan B that you would have to contribute more, so more people would have to put more money in the pot.
Okay.
But the only equivalence that I can think of in my role as a political analyst, mm-hmm. is to say that the left has to acknowledge, look, we do have a legitimate debt crisis that threatens our overall economic health, and there are going to have to be some cuts to entitlements in order to make those programs secure for the future. You can't just play politics with it. But to my mind, the president is offering, as you put it, $3 in cuts for every $1 in tax hikes. And in some cases, we're just talking about closing loopholes and deductions on the very rich. So it's not, to my mind, a real equivalence.
Catherine in East New York, you're on WNYC with Juan Williams. Hello.
Hi. I'm calling to applaud Juan because he's 100% right. We've gotten to the point where it's not just political correctness, it's the thought police. And if you're going to shut people down as soon as they're saying something that you want to start to label immediately, then you're not going to be able to convince anybody of anything. You're not going to be able to change opinions. You only change opinions when you allow a truthful and vibrant discussion.
Well, thanks. I mean, that's what I think, and that's why I'm saying, okay, so Brian says, well, what do you think about the idea that some people view Fox as biased? Well, I think, you know, I'm there, and I'm trying to persuade people, and I'm making a different point of view known. I don't think that's wrong. I don't think that means that, you know, I'm just a fool for and being used. I think that as a journalist, well, why not have a journalist who has a different point of view on the show?
Dwight on Staten Island. You're on WNYC with Juan Williams. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Thank you. I just want to challenge Juan Williams because he's speaking about intellectual honesty, and I think it's very intellectually dishonest to say that if he's expressing a fear of Muslims dressed in Muslim garb on an airplane, that this can be an outgrowth of 9/11. Really, on 9/11, those hijackers were not dressed in Muslim garb. They were shaved, and they looked as Western as can be. And before they did what they did, they went out to strip clubs and other things which were very haram, according to the Quran. So what Juan Williams did to me, if I could draw an analogy, is the same thing as a white woman saying, oh, you know, I can't help but grab my handbag when I see a black man enter an elevator, even if it's based on a lot of misconceptions and just is highly erroneous. And then he goes on a kind of Jeremiah to paint himself as a victim when he expressed something that was erroneous and is in fact discriminatory.
Well, I disagree. I don't think it's discriminatory at all to express my feeling. And as you heard in terms of the larger context, I went on to, in fact, argue against basing any discriminatory policy or action on the feeling that people might have in terms of anxiety at seeing those who are dressed in Muslim garb on an airplane. Now, you said, well, of course, the 9/11 attackers were not dressed in Muslim garb. So I would not have had any reason then to jump to make a conclusion or feeling, express a feeling about people in Muslim garb. To the contrary, I'm saying to you, in this situation, I am aware that these people are first and foremost identifying themselves as Muslims. And that's why, in that context, I would have the reaction that I still do have. And then finally, you said, oh, but it's like this white woman in the elevator clutching her purse. And again, if the woman has that reaction based on stereotypes, whatever, it's still her feeling. And you want to have a discussion with her about it. But to ask her not to express it and say just the expression of her feeling is bigotry, I think is asking someone to shut up, don't tell us how you feel, and then it leads to, I think, you know, terrible actions by people who think, oh, I'm not allowed to say how I feel, but I really don't like those people. Better to have the discussion.
Dwight, you want to come back on that?
You know, I just, again, I'd say I don't think that if, and again, in the analogy that I'm drawing, that that white woman would have a right to remain a personality on NPR based on the sentiment she expressed, which is her right to feel. I wouldn't take anybody's right to feel something away from them, but that woman, if that's her sentiment, that's what she feels free to express on the air. She doesn't have a right to remain an NPR personality. And I just think it's disingenuous, again, to come out and pretend that he's just this victim of muzzling when what he expressed was A, erroneous from a conceptual level, and B, it was just discriminatory.
Thank you very much. I want to play a clip from the 6-minute exchange that you had with Bill O'Reilly that led to all of this, not having to do with what you said about your fear of people in Muslim garb as you board airplanes, or the fact that that shouldn't be based, that shouldn't be a basis for making public policy, something that turns out to be eerily relevant to the news of the day, because you started talking with O'Reilly about Europe, and we know what just happened in Norway. So here is about a minute from that same exchange. Juan Williams, Bill O'Reilly, a lot of crosstalk here. It sounds very much like the O'Reilly factor, and O'Reilly speaks first.
So if there's only a few and a couple and just in the mountains of Pakistan, that's all, why is Angela Merkel having such a hard time? Why are the French banning burqas? You know, why does that?
Because they have a problem because people have stopped emphasizing, and she went on to say this, integration, assimilation.
Why,
people know
Juan?
You can just live side by side. That was wrongheaded, and because she sees it as a threat, I think she pointed out that two of every three or so children under the age of five
who
in Germany
is causing the problem in Germany? Is it the Muslims who have come there or the Germans?
Absolutely.
Who's causing the problem?
No, wait. You see, you did it again. It's extremists. It's people who refuse to assimilate into German society. They're the ones that are causing that problem.
According to Merkel, it's not extremists. It's most of the 5 million Muslims who have come there.
You want to talk about that?
Well, again, I I'm challenging O'Reilly. You know, I mean, it's a full-throated debate, and it's fast-paced. It's cable news. There's a limited time. He's a strong, dominant personality, and I'm fighting back, and I'm the guest. He's the host. It's his show. But I'm clearly, I think I'm the one who's voicing the need for tolerance in this situation and trying to say, you know what, let's not make harsh or spontaneous judgments that would lead to discriminatory action against people. But that in Europe, they are having huge arguments that are very real. And we've just seen it, as you pointed out, Brian, take a sad turn in the last week.
Linda in Princeton, you're on WNYC with Juan Williams. Hello.
Oh, good morning. I just had sort of a comment slash question. Mr. Williams and other people on the media, not just him, throw around the word conservative without ever defining it. I think it should be defined at the beginning of each conversation, because I'm on the extreme left, but I'm not militant. Let's put it that way. I'm not an anarchist, but I'm on the left. For example, people are constantly allowing Nancy Pelosi to be called a member of the left.
And what's your question?
My question is, would he define conservative, and would he define reactionary? And
all right, you got to do it in 20 seconds.
I don't know how to define it in this context. I mean, it must be some context, but there's social conservatives, there are economic conservatives, there are cultural conservatives, and in many cases, there are people who are religious conservatives who try to bring their religious perspective into the conversation. I'm not sure exactly what you're driving at.
I know you got to go in a minute. How do people on the right relate to you now? I think you're a hero to them only for being a victim of NPR and dishing it to NPR after that. But then you open your mouth and you say mostly liberal things about the country and the world. So how do audiences receive you? What kind of mail do you get?
Well, you know, I mean, it's not a popularity game for me. I was trying to, you know, but the thing is, Brian, people, I must say, you know, as I'm walking around town today, people are very supportive, and I really am grateful. They seem to understand overwhelmingly, hey, you know what? You're an honest broker. You say things I don't agree with sometimes, but I don't have a sense that you have an agenda, that you're in the box like a lot of these people who are provocateurs, who just say things to try to draw attention to themselves or to raise their ratings, that you really are trying to tell us what you see as the driving force, the dynamics behind any debate, as we were just discussing the budget debate on Capitol Hill. That's what I was trying to do, and I appreciate the fact that people have a sense of who I am.
And real quick, I saw in your book's press release, but I couldn't find it in my quick read of the book,
right,
that you identified journalists and politicians who are doing a good job of surmounting the muzzling culture. Do you name names on the good side?
Oh, sure. And I think that it's really important to say that I think there are people who are, you take, for example, I don't think there's any question, if you look at the nightly news hour, you know, Jim Lehrer and others, I think there are people out there who are making an effort to try. I think David Brooks at the Times, if you want someone on the more conservative side, who make an effort to try to tell you what is going on in this country. But, you know, there are people who then say they'd rather have, especially in this new media landscape, everything in a box. Are you a liberal or a conservative, and don't vary? Well, I am like the skunk in the middle of the road. I get hit from both sides at times.
So you're not only for unmuzzling, you're for complexity.
I don't mind nuance in discussion. And by the way, as someone who's often in New York, I think you might be guilty of nuance discussions too.
Uh-oh. This may be sticking to me. Muzzled, the assault on honest debate. Juan Williams, you can no longer hear him on NPR. You can't see him on the Fox News channel. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now, after speaking with Juan Williams and getting his critique of the mainstream media, we're going to open up the phones to ask you listeners what stories have been left underreported recently. We have about 6 or 7 minutes before our next guest. Call right up just to talk about stories that have flown under the radar that you think need more attention right now. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. We'll take your calls right after this. And then Douglas Rushkoff answers the question, which is kind of a segue out of Juan in a way, is Murdoch newspaper hacking the moral equivalent of pro-WikiLeaks hacking? Stay with us.